Welcome, everyone. This is Sparkle On with Davey Jags. Sparkle is your happiness, passion, and self-worth, and nothing can dull your light. Today, we have Jimmy Spencer, sports media executive, who is senior vice president for talent partnerships at Uninterrupted, which is founded by Maverick Carter and LeBron James. Jimmy is also a big mental health advocate, which is how we connected. And his career is super impressive, but he's also co-founded Cheat Code Foundation, which aims to help communities find mental health resources and different modalities in communities that don't typically get the care that they need. So thank you, Jimmy, for joining us today.
Yes, awesome.
Yeah, and I know that we've talked before, but you were one of the first hires at the Spring Hill Company. And so can you talk a little bit about how you got involved with the team and starting that company early on?
Yeah, so my whole career was based around storytelling in some form or fashion. Even as a kid, I was writing newspapers in my upstairs on old school Microsoft Publisher. We're talking about, you know, 1993. I'm old. It didn't seem old at the time, but I was always somebody who was interested in love sports. Was never like you, a great athlete. I didn't have like a college basketball career or anything like that. I tapped out in high school, but I always had a love for sports, and at the same time, really struggled in school. So I was trying to figure out, usually you get that, now that I've never really thought of it this way, you get like that jock that's great at sports but struggles in school. Mm-hmm. No one tells you the story about the kid that wasn't that good at sports and also struggled in school. I didn't get either of those gifts. And most of my struggles in school were, I mean, to this day, you know, ask me to do a math problem, ask me to like follow directions in some form or fashion, I really struggle to do it. It's generally, you know, my strength has always been in relationships and a little bit of writing, but I always tell the story that I failed high school English because I was so anxious that I wouldn't go to class. I just had to get out of there, and I couldn't pay attention because I was anxious and running. So the story, which I'm sure we'll talk about, but the story of kind of my mental health also really interfered with my education in school early ages. And but what that all led me to was a career, funny enough, in sports writing. And I went to Sacramento State University. I was I think I entered the school as like a criminal justice major. Don't ask me why. Then I was in marketing. Don't ask me why. Though I have obviously circled back over to that space very much so. And then I really found my love writing, and I wrote for the student newspaper. I got a love for storytelling. I think that like ego of like, oh my gosh, people are reading what I'm writing. This is incredible. Like my own brother doesn't listen to me when I talk. Like I can, and so I was a writer in all sorts of, I would say, mediums. Mostly, you know, I was a newspaper writer at the very beginning, worked for the Sacramento Bee newspaper while still in school. But at the time, digital media was coming along. And then fast forward years later, working through digital media, sports writing, when Maverick and LeBron were creating Uninterrupted, the idea was, how do we let athletes tell stories their own way and through their lens? Obviously not getting rid of or replacing traditional media. It was just adding a new media.
Right.
And we created Uninterrupted for that reason. It started with selfie videos and all sorts of things. And I came down and, you know, interviewed with Maverick. He was really one of the first people to ever, I would say, help me understand my gift, you know. And his thing was, you can walk into a room with anybody and, you know, get along and understand who they are and what they're trying to do and what kind of story they want to tell. And it always takes somebody to do that in our lives, somebody who's going to reach out and almost put themselves on the line to say, I'm going to take a bet on you, and here's where I see your strength. And the first guy to ever tell me too, don't worry so much about your weaknesses, focus more on your strengths. And I did that, and I leaned into that. And over the last 9 years now, I've got to work alongside him and the company and really understand how to move in this crazy space of sports marketing and entertainment.
Yeah, and I love your background as a writer. I think that's how we connected originally, because I also, like, yes, I was that jock, but I really struggled in school, and, you know, I struggled on those, like, state tests, and I was actually put in, like, a writing class that was for kids who really struggled on the state testing, even though I ended up having writing be part of my profession, and it doesn't, you know, those tests don't determine what you can do to express yourself.
Yes.
But I remember being in like my 11th grade or maybe 12th grade English class, and my running career had taken such a turn, and my mental health was terrible. But we had an assignment where we had to like replicate Hamlet's soliloquy. And so I did like to run or to rest because it was this mental health battle that I was facing at the time where I was addicted to running. And I didn't know how to express that to anyone because you don't think of addiction as to exercise.
Yeah.
But it's so fascinating when I hear stories like yours where, yes, we struggled in school, but writing was that form of expression that you can't really put in the box of a curriculum.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, especially that type of creative writing. Or, and it's funny, those tests, whether it's like SATs or even essays when you're writing in school, are very formulaic, which I didn't. I was going to say no one taught me that. Someone was teaching me that. I probably was not listening when they were teaching me that. I was just hanging out, staring into my fears. But I think that when I later, because I taught, I had like a weird slice of life where I was a high school English teacher for 2 years and coached basketball during that time. I'd coached basketball for 5 years total and did 2 years while also being a teacher, an English teacher of all things. So
That's amazing.
Guy who had failed English came back to teach English. And when I learned the formula, I was like telling kids, I was like, this is actually pretty easy if you want to do well on these on SATs and state tests. It's like very much formulaic though. And then I started to look back at like how I was probably writing essays, which was like thoughts just everywhere, you know, and no organization to the writing, which in creative writing or, you know, even journalism in some realms, like you can get away with that because it's you're telling a story and that story can flow many different ways. But I think for young people out there, whether it's writing or any other subject or area, you can have a passion for something and still not succeed at it early on because you're just not matching up with the expectations that one person has in one narrow category. But imagine like, imagine being an amazing long distance runner, but only being tested on sprinting.
Right.
And then suddenly you're like, wait a second, I didn't even know there was this long distance running thing. I was just sprinting the whole time. And so I think how many different variations of that are in our lives. There's probably great writers out there who are trying to write animation and don't know that they would be excellent doing long form documentaries. Or, you know, it's just we all got to continue to try and find that right thing for ourselves.
Yeah, I think, you know, when I have to try to get out of my own head, I will write a scene or a chapter in the form of like maybe a script, which is uncomfortable for me because I typically write, you know, essay or personal memoir. And sometimes writing it in a fictionalized script actually reveals what I'm trying to say.
Interesting.
So sometimes I think writing can be like a great mental health tool to really uncover that subconscious anxiety or, you know, your authentic value. But yeah, I think going into a little bit more about your storytelling work at Uninterrupted, you guys have the slogan, more than an athlete. And when you've obviously been such a pivotal figure at the company, how have you incorporated mental health in these nuanced stories that you are telling, especially through the lens of athletes, which seems to resonate with mass audiences, even if they are not athletes?
Yeah. Because, you know, I've struggled with my own mental health. And when I say that, really, you know, anxiety for me. And I think about a lot of the thoughts that I tell myself are just not true. Or that, you know, I deal with a lot of like lies. And it's not, I'm lucky in the sense that I don't think I fall into depression. You know, I've had bouts of that, like I think most people. Lucky to say I haven't had that. However, the anxiety and like the intrusive thoughts and something they call pure O, which is like obsessive compulsive without the compulsion side. That's where I've always struggled. And mine could be around feeling like I'm sick and like they've used the term hypochondria for years, but like things like that where I'll worry or I'll feel trapped in meetings or I'll feel like, you know, even in a setting like this, like suddenly I got to control my scenario. And if you and I didn't have a friendship where I felt like I could just get up and go if I needed to,
right,
I might start to feel really trapped and sink into my body. And I didn't even know that that was not normal when I was a kid. And so I was 12 years old struggling to sit in math class because I felt like I was going to like internally explode or I was afraid I was going to throw up or I just didn't realize that that was something that I was going through mentally. It wasn't like it's a physical thing, but it wasn't. And so I say all that because I think I've going through that myself created a really strong empathy for what other people deal with that I may not understand. Like, what does depression feel like? I don't think I truly know and understand. And so I listen a lot to what people are describing and what they're saying, and whether that's someone who I'm really close with, a family member, or if it's a friend or someone I just met. And so with athletes, I never changed. I just always wanted to understand what made somebody tick and what made somebody go. And so, and the stories that we do tell, they range from, you know, the most surface level kind of anecdotal interesting moments to really deep dives into, like, you know, human psychology and thought. And, you know, we just did a project on Black men's mental health with a group called the Judd Foundation, you know, and we just released a trailer today with Master P and his son Mercy Miller, who's a star basketball player going to University of Houston. And that was really on the nose for mental health. Like, it was talking about, like, what does it look like from one generation to another? And then sometimes we're doing things that talk about addiction. And how does that tie into the mental health side of things? How does, and so we are not a quote unquote mental health company, but I see mental health like oxygen. You know, it's everybody deals with it. And sometimes, I don't know if you feel this way as somebody who's really kind of been, I think, at the forefront of sharing, especially as an athlete and as, you know, someone who's a writer, that, you know, now I'll watch commercials and you see mental health, mental health, mental health. And like, there's half of me that's like, this is amazing. And then the other half's like, oh no, is this just going to get like, whitewashed in a way where it no longer means anything, because we're just calling everything mental health and it's a mental health issue and it's this and this. And then I'm like, oh, is that really just the human condition? Which gets back to more than an athlete. I'm more than your entertainment. I'm more than an athlete. I am a human experiencing this world, just like you, just like everyone. Here's my story. And so with Uninterrupted, we've had the luxury of telling great stories and being able to have the license to do it in that way. Not bound by having to scream at each other for ratings or having to argue about, you know, who's got the best left hand or, you know, anything that I think the mindless stuff that you could find anywhere. We really like digging into the heart of storytelling in that way.
Yeah. I know that we talked about this, you know, like I think last week when we ran into each other getting coffee, but, yes, I think I do feel that way where everything's mental health, mental health, mental health, but it's not getting into that more deep rooted nuance of the intersectionality. And I guess I'm wondering, in your professional life, I think it comes down to conversations like this with community. And so how do you build your teams or handpick these stories where you can, you know, dive into it a little bit deeper and then showcase that for mass media?
Yeah, I think it's hard to do, first off. And the reason is we're not always ready to share our story. And I can't tell somebody that they're ready to tell their story in any way, to uncover their, you know, and again, it's not always like, I'm making it sound like it's dark and like, it's not always that way, but any part of your story, whether that's like saying, I love golf, but I suck at golf, or what, you know, that's a very light version of it. And I think when we, the thing that I always do is you try and create open space. And it's like any great friend or therapist, it's like, how much listening are you doing? Are you coming from a place of empathy? And I think a lot of questions can start with like, oh, would you think somebody would be interested in hearing that, you know? And that question of would someone benefit from that, I think starts to spark. Because if you're, I mean, look, some of these athletes that we deal with are uber famous, successful, you know, like money, following, all those things. For them, they don't know what's not normal. Because at 15 years old, they were already, you know, the king or queen of their castle. And I think for many of them, you can say, oh, you realize like what you did is not like normal. I know you're among peers that do the same thing you do, but like, let's say you're a soccer player and like you were moved out of your home and brought to a club at 15 years old, 14 years old. Like that must have been kind of hard, like not having mom and dad around, right? Like, oh yeah, I guess, yeah, it was, you know, or you're 18 years old, you're drafted to Major League Baseball. You didn't go to college like everyone else. You went to like the middle of nowhere America. Now imagine if you weren't a white guy and you were in the middle of nowhere America playing baseball. That's a culture shock, depending on where you're from. And what was that experience like? Oh, I didn't even realize. And sometimes you're helping them discover these things, because we're dealing with athletes who are, some are retired and have really had a reflection time, and others are 16 years old, 22 years old, you know, and really young. And so you're just trying to help them understand what story, that their story, what that story is. So the answer to your question is we always start with understanding their story, picking story point. That's the beauty of my journalism background. I understand kind of beginning, middle, end of story. And then we have just an incredible development group that can sit there and take a story then and really say, here's how we're going to tell it. Here's how we're going to do it. We work with so many excellent directors. I get to kind of at that point step away and just kind of help be a friend to the athlete at that point as they tell their story.
Right.
But a lot of my stuff is intake, filter. Okay, should you meet with our unscripted team? Mm-hmm. Is this branded content? Is this something that a brand is interested in partnering in? And so, yeah, that's the long answer to that question, but yeah.
And then, you know, what a lot of people don't realize, I mean, they do and they don't, but the effort and energy that goes behind building up these athletes and their platforms and their stories. And so I think even stories like as sports executives kind of goes under that radar, especially as it relates to mental health. And you've been open about how your mental health has impacted your personal, but also your professional life. You talked about you had these feelings at 12 years old, but when was the moment that you actually realized it was impacting your life in a way that you needed to make a change?
Yeah. So the first time I can remember these feelings coming up, there's probably a lot of people relate to this, but I can remember when I was like in fifth grade starting to stress about school and staying up late at night and then starting like fears. I had a lot of fears and my fears were sometimes I think because I probably watched too much on TV, which is something now as a dad, like I'm very thoughtful about what are my kids seeing, what images, and it's terrible. Sometimes you're watching like a sports game and you see this like thriller trailer with like gore and I'm like looking at my 5-year old like, what is this putting into him right now? You know, it's, and so I think I had a lot of that. I had, you know, a dad who was a firefighter paramedic who I think was probably too liberal with the stories he told that created things. I was watching Rescue 911 and Cops and I was America's Most Wanted. These are all like 90s shows that were terrifying to watch, you know, as an elementary school student. And so I started to create these fears. But then, too, if someone told me about an aneurysm or a cancer or a heart attack, I immediately was like, I have that thing. And I'm fearful I have that thing. And I can remember at a very early age being very fearful and aware of all of that. And when I was in sixth grade is when it really started. I had a math class, Miss Campbell's math class. I remember I sat. They would seat you. Remember, like, you could pick a seat wherever. I wanted to be by the door every time. But I wasn't always so lucky. And I needed to get up to go to the bathroom because I was like, I literally felt like I was going to throw up in class. And it was like a really physical manifestation of my anxiety. But the second I was out of that classroom, I felt better. But when I was in that classroom, every minute felt like an hour. And I was watching that clock. I was not paying attention to what she was doing. I wasn't laughing. I wasn't smiling. I hated it every minute. And I think that's when my parents started to realize something was up. Like something was going wrong here. There was like a threat almost to like, we're going to have to take you to see a therapist if you don't fix this. And so I, and it wasn't that they were being harsh. It's just, that's how it came across to me at 12 years old. And it felt like something's wrong with me. And my friends seemed to like just enjoy going to school. I hate school. I hate like getting dropped off in the morning. I relish Friday afternoons and Saturdays. And Sundays are scary for me. And so I, In that 12-year-old version of me where fear was so heightened, you know, and then that kind of moved away from that. I wasn't afraid of throwing up anymore. Seventh grade, I was afraid I was going to have an aneurysm. Like, that was, like, a big fear. And, like, you could see this, like, oh, my gosh, this poor kid. Now I can look back and this poor kid was just fearful of all these very irrational things. I used to sit there and, like, dread so much social interaction, school, and I had a small group of friends and I had things, and it kind of would get better and it would ebb and flow through life. And even, you know, freshman year of high school, it was like loving life. I was killing it in school. I was on a roll, you know, had like my first girlfriend, had like, I was like, this is what life's supposed to be like. And sophomore year, I had a trigger where some girl in class threw up in class because she smoked too much at lunch.
Oh, geez.
And, yeah, oh, geez is right. And that, like, I saw all the shame on her. Oh. And I saw the way, like, she turned into, like, that person. Even just that moment, it's probably forgotten the next day by so many. I'm talking about it, you know, however many years later. Because then I became, again, fearful of that happening to me. And so that class became my new sixth grade Miss Campbell's math class where I couldn't sit there and I struggled feeling like, how am I going to get through this class? So I, difference between being 12 and at that point 15 was, at 15, I just decided I'm not going to school anymore. I'm just going to like dip out, after lunch, I'm not going to go. I was able to play the system. Phone calls come at home. I dodged the phone calls, did detentions without my parents knowing, forged signatures, like everything you can to just escape school. Mm. Surprisingly pretty easy to do, by the way.
Yeah.
and I, but I went from, you know, being an honor roll student freshman year of high school to a 0.5 GPA, and they were going to take basketball away. I had to get my grades up. I was on academic probation. I was going through all this stuff, and I still didn't know. I still was just like, I'm just this weak person. Like, I have this thing, but I didn't recognize mental health. Like, what that back then was not ever talked about. Like,
right.
This idea of anxiety or something could help me. And it's so sad because, gosh, I just missed a chunk of my life. Mm-hmm. Like, a chunk that I could have really enjoyed. Like, freshman year, I was loving life. Sophomore year, hating it. And these things were, you know, when I look back and I kind of start to, years of therapy now, I've started to really, like, unpack what that was, you know? And it's like, okay, when I was young, my parents got divorced. Suddenly I didn't, you know, and I lived with my grandparents. Then I didn't have like a father figure in the house for a good chunk of time, for the majority of the time. Mm-hmm. And I was scared, which could be a natural, normal thing. Like, you know, suddenly you feel like, okay, single mom is different. I don't have this level of protection. And there was always kind of a rhyme. In sophomore year, it was really hard. My grandmother passed away. So I saw someone die of cancer and had this really terrible ending where I watched her pass and this person I was really close with. And I think all these things started to compound over the years. And it wasn't, even in college, this stuff would pop up again. And I'm like, but you could control it and leave class. College was bigger. I could choose to sit by the door, which is always a big thing for me, you know? And it kind of like went away, but then it showed up in my professional life many times. But the worst it was 2019. Mm-hmm. Was I right before the pandemic and everything. It all hit me back. And instead now this fear that I was going to throw up turned into like this fear that, I don't know, I was like, I can't even describe it. Like I was going to combust. It almost felt like mini panic attacks. I get like dizzy right in between my eyes and I couldn't sit in meetings. It was, if I wasn't able to get up and out, if I was presenting something, like I would feel flush. And I didn't really know why. I didn't understand what it was, but it was all this same thing that was happening when I was 12 and 15 and 19. It was all just coming back now, but this time, you know, 2019, doing the quick math, 35 years, 36 years old. And it all flooded back in a way where I was like, okay, now I kind of know about, I'm older, smarter a little bit, mental health. I've heard about mental health. I think I have anxiety. And my best friend, who's a therapist, this guy, Dr. Armando Gonzalez, he was basically helping me. I finally like almost, sounds funny to say, but it's like, I like came out to him with anxiety. I was like, man, like I got this really bad anxiety. He recommended a type of therapy called brain spotting, which is visualization and bilateral music and really processing narrative style. I met with a woman who practiced it and was really, really great, in Century City here in LA. And I found amazing healing. My brain like wanted to heal itself and it was finding connection points and it was doing certain things. And I was so thankful. And that's started with athletes. And, you know, this story has been told, The Athletic wrote a great story on it with Dansby Swanson, one of the athletes who I met with, who's at the time was with the Atlanta Braves. And he and I really kind of connected on our shared conversation around anxiety. And he actually ended up working with Armando and now is like publicly talked about his work with Armando and the work he's done to overcome a lot of his own things. But I started to see, oh, this stuff is working. Like this type of methodology is really helpful. And I told Armando, I said, you're making a lot of, I mean, he's worked with Lindsey Vonn, wrote about him in her book. Like he's worked with tons of athletes, Tennessee Titans. He's with UCLA now. He's doing a lot of great stuff. But I've said to him then, and I say to him now, I said, it's great that you're making really successful people more successful, but what about everybody else? Mm-hmm. And is inequality now going to become mental health? Like is mental health going to be the next inequality that we have where certain groups of people are going to have the help and generationally their families are going to be affected? Obviously it's going to disproportionately affect not just socioeconomic, but people of color. It's impossible to find a therapist for black men. Like that is like a known stat. There's just so few therapists who are black men. And, you know, the importance of mirroring somebody's experience and understanding in therapy. Mm-hmm. And frankly, there's not enough therapists for the amount of people who need therapy.
You're right.
And so I think technology and all these things. But anyway, that's how Cheat Code Foundation came about, was how do we do that? And we're still, you know, knocking on the door, figuring out how do we train not just mental health experts, but how do we train coaches and teachers and people who work at, you know, homes and these things to be able to practice this with people in their everyday life.
That's amazing. And that is one of the things that I think, like, not just in companies, but in general, like, how can we help the communities that need it access the different types of care? Because there's so many diverse modalities. And then specifically, you kind of touched on this point, but with your children, being a father, how have you started to have these conversations with, you have two young boys.
Yeah.
And, you know, we see boys struggle a lot, especially young boys, because there's a stigma in athletes, but just across the board. So how are you having these conversations early on?
Yeah, I the good thing for my boys and the good thing for, I think, a lot of children now is parents who are definitely more aware and understanding of things. And so I'm constantly asking the question, like, where is this behavior coming from? Mm. Where's this thought? Where's this, whether it's a fear or this? And what one thing I never do anymore is say to them, like, don't worry about it, because that never works. But it is it's something that I, you know, with both my boys who are both in elementary school, they're so young, they don't understand the emotions and the feelings they have. Mm-hmm. But we are definitely those parents. And my wife, who's a school psychologist, is like the expert at it. She's so great at being able to help even me in moments of frustration, be able to know, like, hey, I think, you know, he's going through this. And I think this is why. And by the way, like, no coincidence, this is happening when school is coming back and homework's a lot now. And so, like, it's really hard to be a parent. I thought it was really hard when they were infants because you're waking up every moment and you're like constantly working. But that's like the hard labor of parenting.
Right.
I'm just now getting into like the, I don't know, you call it like the white collar labor of these real things that you got to make the right decision. Like, what am I going to say here? You don't want to play soccer anymore? Like, is that coming from a place of fear, or is that like, should I really listen to you and just say, hey, right, you're out on soccer. Okay, I respect that. Like, there's these decisions all the time. Or somebody did this to you at school. Like, oh, it sucks. Like, I want you to be able to, like, say this, but, like, let's process what that felt like.
Right.
And then, you know, you worry. I would then worry, too. I'm, like, becoming too hippy-dippy, and, like, I need to, like, lay down the law. And so you feel, like, always torn. And I had a therapist friend of mine at one point say, like, every kid's going to end up in therapy, and it's either not enough hugs or too many hugs. And it's like, no matter what, they're going to end up that way. We're all these kind of, you know, individuals that need support, need kind of help fixing ourselves. But it's definitely something that we keep top of mind in the house.
Do you think the mental health crisis in young people is worse than when you were a kid? Or do you think there's just more awareness around it now?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I wish I had an answer. I don't have the expertise to know, and I'm sure there's real experts that would probably like laugh me off for trying to, but my opinion of it is that there is more awareness. Sometimes I think that can turn into, and even I fall victim to this, which is feeling like a victim, like feeling like, oh, I'm aware of this thing. So that becomes something that I'm more likely to gravitate toward, right?
Right.
And so I do think there is more that we've discovered this, you know, mental health is, but that hyper awareness is probably bringing us to a place of we're attaching ourselves more to diagnoses than we are saying, oh, I had a hard day, but it's like I'm anxious. We're just using different language for things that have always existed. At the same time, I do think there's a unique, like, the space that we're in now. I joked about this the other day where I was watching just a couple months ago, I was at a baseball game. I was watching the center fielder for the Mariners, this kid, Julio Rodriguez, and he's literally just in the outfield the whole time, just staring at like the batter. And I was like, he's really practicing mindfulness. Like, this is no phone, nothing. I was like, this is incredible. Like, I can't remember the last time I spent 3 hours just like standing somewhere. And when I do think it was when I was a kid, when it was the 90s, and then we didn't have cell phones, we didn't have social media. I know all these things get, but you can't tell me that that is not having a detrimental effect on our mental health. If we know that mindfulness, being able to unplug, being able to like stare off in the distance, being bored, all these things, if we know that that's good for us, it's things that we quote unquote practice, then what's keeping us from that practice is oftentimes technology. And I am the worst at it. You give me 4 seconds and I'm going to take out my phone and open some app and start doing that. okay, I've gone through this app, start over again, back to this app. And, you know, I didn't have that when I was young. Right. And I know kids now, depending on the age, do. There's also like Netflix, and there's like this judgment from friends and keeping up. Like, I can't imagine what it is to be a teenager at this point with constant measuring up against your peers and like who follows you, who likes you, who doesn't, who's interacting. I watch, you know, kids and teenagers go through this as athletes too, of like, how many followers do you have as like an athlete? It's like, oh my gosh, how could this not have a negative effect on the mental health of this generation and kids and parents too, who are also now addicted to all these things and not as present. And so I think you put all that on there, you turn on like election news, and it's like, I had this, not to turn this show into a political show, but I had a friend of mine this morning tell me, you know, he's like, one of the reasons why I really just don't want Donald Trump to be president is because his son, who's like, I guess 7 years old now, he's like, cause he'll be the president until he's 11. And that's, my kid's going to grow up with that as the example of president for that amount of time. Mm-hmm. And it's not even necessarily, it's just, when I was a kid, we didn't have that with politicians, right? We didn't have this constant news cycle, even with sports. Like people weren't tearing down athletes the way they tear down athletes now. And so the behaviors are different. Like it starts to get scary because you think we're at this, like, and then climate change, like people were worried about World War II. Like I was worried about earthquakes. Like we've all had things to worry about, but you get into climate and you get into like the political geopolitics, you get into all this stuff. Mm-hmm. It's gotta be a pretty scary time to be all of it through social media and media. Mm-hmm. So I guess the answer is, yeah, I think kids are, especially teenagers, are at a disadvantage now when it comes to their own mental health than ever. Yet at the same time, we have more tools than ever,
right?
Hopefully to counteract and kind of play defense there.
I mean, we were just having this conversation last night at a group called Athletes Touch, and it was about the NIL and player development and the protections of that for compensation purposes, but also, you know, their mental health. And I think we're also kind of forgetting what being a kid means. Yeah. Like these kids that are going to college, they are kids, but they're making multi-million dollar deals. And I don't know if you see that in like coincide in your fatherhood, but then also like in your professional life, where, you know, what does it actually mean to look at an athlete in a holistic sense? But I guess, where have you found the most pivotal conversations being made, whether that's with other parents or with your partner, of how to take care of your own mental health as a parent, but also like your kids and that community?
Yeah, I think that one, being married and having a partner in life has been incredible to go through this experience with. Like without my wife, I don't think I would have recognized so much that I needed to fix. And to like, I think that's where a great partnership is so effective, if you have somebody who can help you grow into like a better person. And that's like so cliche, but it's true. And I tell people all the time that when looking for like, you know, who you're going to be with, who's that romantic partner, and this is maybe now become a little bit more well known, but it's like those romantic feelings and all those things are great. However, like who's going to be a true partner in life?
Right.
Who's going to move along? And so, you know, my wife has helped build this foundation along with me, and we've helped, I think, grow in that way. But remind me of the question again. As I started talking about my wife, I lost the plot.
Yeah. What were like some pivotal conversations you've had either with your partner or other parents in your community? That have, I don't know, I guess, given you hope in the future of mental health for your children and beyond?
Yeah, I would say, honestly, it's the ability to be open like this and have these conversations. And you know, I've always been a big practice what you preach. I'm an open book when it comes to my mental health. And I very much have found healing in my own mental health journey by talking about it with other people, because you always get the same, like, me too. And, oh my gosh, yes. Or, you know, we all have varying degrees. And I think in the community that I live and work and operate in and spend my time in, I think people really understand that about me. And the nice thing is, like, when I tell you, oh, I struggle if I'm like, feel like I'm trapped, but if you know that about me, then I don't feel that way.
Right.
I feel like, oh, then it's excusable if I need to like take a break or I do this. And so, for me, I think I find hope in the fact that more people are that stigma was a really big deal. And mm-hmm. that stigma is squashed, in my opinion. Like, I still think it's not solved and fixed, but we have totally made it okay to go through mental health bouts. Mm-hmm. Everybody speaks a language now. I mean, unless you're like Stone Age, like Rockhead, you will understand if somebody says, like, I'm having a really anxious day. Like, right. you'll relate to it, you'll appreciate it, you'll understand it. And I think more so we're able to say, oh, that is too bad. And also, let's do this, this, and this, versus like, oh no, we gotta like be careful, like don't talk to them, like they're having an anxious day. We're normalizing it in a way where it's okay. It's almost the equivalent of saying, like, I have a headache today, or like mm-hmm. the difference between a headache and I have a migraine, I can't even get out of bed. There's language for that now. And I think that gives me a ton of hope, because we will get the answers. Like, technology, and I don't know, everything scares me sometimes. And I know I've definitely jumped the shark when it comes to being old and just like AI and what that, but like, I will have conversations with ChatGPT now. I'm like that guy where I'm like in my car talking. And I tell you what, like, if, and that is just the start of all of this.
Yeah.
I can definitely see how AI is going to help us with our mental health. Like, I could see everyone having a therapist, a friend, good direction, understanding mindfulness, peacefulness, giving us more breaks. Like, I could see it helping. I don't actually see it hurting. Mm-hmm. I think technology is catching up now to where we can start to fill this void of therapy that's either too expensive.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of therapy is asking questions.
Right.
And if you start processing, imagine AI, and it sounds crazy, like so many people might roll their eyes, like, no way that AI is going to help be my therapist. But you think about all your experiences in therapy, mm-hmm. and obviously there's a lot to have a one-on-one, you know, look somebody in the eye. But imagine those conversations happening and someone's just prompting you to think and process, which is really right. what great therapy is processing and guiding you. And you have this brilliant therapist sitting in the phone of everybody who has a phone. And then compare that to going and paying $175 and driving somewhere, getting on Zoom, mm-hmm. finding somebody who's going to relate, trusting that they're going to be good. And like, I'm not here to replace the whole mental health workforce.
Yeah.
But I am hopeful again that technology and openness and these things are going to continue. As a species, we've continued to adapt and grow. And I think our ability to heal ourselves mentally is next up.
Right. Well, I think what's interesting, you know, there's a lot of people that do fear AI and the effects it can have on people's mental health. But I think what's important to remember is mental health is not one size fits all. So, you know, therapy doesn't always work for everyone, or talk therapy or group therapy. You know, there's different modalities that a different person of their diagnosis might need. And that's where I think we just also have to look at each generation too. Like, this Gen Z generation grew up in a very digital, remote way, especially after the pandemic. So like, we might actually see positive effects from AI. We might see negative effects. We don't know. There's no blueprint.
Could also, yes, end civilization.
Yeah.
Kill us like iRobot.
Yeah. But I do see what you mean. It's like, you know, there is, there are people that fear going into a therapy office and talking to someone one-on-one and prefer Zoom. Whereas like, I'm the complete opposite. I prefer going into an office. But
that
might
be more present when you do that, you know, like if you go into an office and you're with somebody.
Yeah, I think. Okay. So for me, I had an amazing therapist for many, many years, like four or five years. And I think it was the environment of that physical office. It mm-hmm. was the chair. It was the plants. It was the mm-hmm. incense. It was that I didn't have to feel like I had sat upright. If I wanted to snuggle on a blanket, like that was the
Sounds
space.
Great.
Yeah. That was the space that Ellen, miss her. She retired, but nothing happened. No, she retired. She lives a beautiful life in Colorado now, but, that it was a space that she provided. But you know, sometimes people go into a therapy's office and some people don't realize that they have to try many therapists before they get that level of comfort that I might have had. Yeah. And that is actually one of my fears going back into therapy, because I've taken about a year or two off now mm-hmm. just to kind of like process and really write. But now I've come to the point where I'm like, okay, I think I just need to keep up that weekly maintenance or that biweekly maintenance mm-hmm. Because of my own anxiety and like bipolar depression. But mm-hmm. I know I might have to go through five therapists to find that fit again. And maybe it will look like over Zoom. Maybe it'll look like group therapy. I'm not really sure, but I think it also changes for the different chapters of your life.
Yeah. That can be daunting, that process. yeah. if you've never done it. And yeah. you know, you have an Ellen to know this is what it should look like. This is what it should feel like. And then you think about those people who have never tried it.
Right.
And they go in, they don't know they have a great therapist or a bad therapist, mm-hmm. if they're having a good experience or a bad experience. And you know, therapy is not, it's not instant. You don't go in and like, okay, great, that was it, I'm done. Like, it's not like going to a chiropractor or something. Like, right. there's not immediate cracks, and it is a trust in the process. And there's sometimes you show up and you're like, I don't even know if I have anything to talk about. Like, we're mm-hmm. forcing conversation. The therapist is probably in that mode too. Mm-hmm. But the breakthrough could be the next week. It could be a moment here or there. And I've been lucky enough to find a great therapist, but I too took a break over the summer and I've been delaying going back. Part of that is, you know, I'm also too, like, one big thing that I don't want to hide, which is the use of an SSRI for mm-hmm. me.
Yeah.
You know, and for me, it's been something I was off of it. I was on it later in life, like 2019, I went on it, mm-hmm. didn't find the right dosage really to help me. Then, you know, and SSRI too, just, I'm sure those listening can Google it, but it's, you know, Prozac or Lexapro or these right. anti-anxiety medications that really help level you in a lot of ways, which I was always fearful. It's going to change my personality. Am I going to be like boisterous anymore? Am I going to, like, I'm still the same person. I still act insane all the time with my friends. Like, I'm an odd, loose person to this day as I was then and now. Mm-hmm. And it hasn't changed me, but it has helped me a lot. And for the lack of side effects relative, I think for a while I was like, well, I want to be like super clean. Like, I'm going to eat clean. I'm not going to like take anything, and I'm not going to take Lexapro and this. And I ended up coming back on Prozac at the last 6 months or so. Mm. So pretty recently.
Right.
And I felt so much better. Mm-hmm. But the biggest thing is the stress and inflammation in my body that my anxiety was causing was far more unhealthy than any hypothetical side effects of long-term use of an SSRI. And I'm sure there's some doctor that may disagree or agree, but for the most part, I'm telling anecdotally for myself, an SSRI has really helped. And the reason I bring that up is because I never want to present myself as somebody's like, oh, I just do the work and I yeah. work out and I'm great. Like, no, I also have this like massive cheat code of this thing that I believe is like just such a tool for people to feel better that we have. And there's a lot of tools, like if you have high cholesterol and you're prone to high cholesterol, like taking statins, like that's a great tool that right. we have. Like, we're lucky to have these tools. And an SSRI is one of those things that, like, if people who struggle with anxiety and struggle with depression and have for a long period of time and have done the work, look at it as like a little bit of a lift up off the ground for a while, even if it just means doing it for a little while to get up off the ground, get the work in, mm-hmm. and then go without it again and see where you are. But that's something that I think when I used to talk about mental health, I left that out of the conversation. And right. I don't know if that was stigma, if it was like, oh, I want people to really believe in therapy, that that's the way, so let's not bring up this other thing. But I'm like, no, like, I need to be strong and say that thing has really helped me.
I 100% agree. I think at least where I had the stigma, because I'm also on Prozac and I've been on and off of Prozac since 2017.
Nice. Prozac should sponsor this show.
I know, right? I'm going to contact them this yeah, after this yeah. show. But I think with my journey of like getting on Prozac, it came at a time where I was the most like mentally unstable. I was in an emotionally abusive relationship. I was walking around my college campus like my chest tight, not being able to breathe, you know, leaving class because I would just end up in tears I do know the emotional abusive relationship was a big part of it.
Yeah.
But even when I was out of it, like, and I was on Prozac, it was like, it wasn't 100% there. And it took months to even really figure that out. And then it was like to the point where I was hospitalized, where they put me on mood stabilizers and things like that. But that's what I associated medication with, was like these emergency situations. And then as I grew into an environment that was healthier, I started to realize it's like sometimes that low dose medication is really what can just help you day to day.
Yeah.
And even now, like, I take my Prozac every other day, because what a lot of people don't realize is Prozac stays in your bloodstream for over 24 hours. So depending on your level of anxiety and like the point of where you're at in your life, you might just need that little dosage just to stay chemically balanced. But like, I still go to therapy. Well, not like I said, not for 2 years, but I was still going to therapy. I still do yoga, Reiki, all those things. But it's not about like, oh, I do this, 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 let me check it off. It's just like where you're at in your life. Because Sometimes Prozac has helped me. Most of the time it keeps me level. But if it's a very high stressful period, there's other modalities that I need to like exercise. So it's kind of like building this like mental health like toolkit.
Yes.
And seeing what works for you. And it's analyzing the like where you're at in the phase of your life, whether it's job, whether it's a sport. Like I just ran the Chicago Marathon.
Oh yeah,
this weekend.
That's right. How'd it
go? Oh, it was the best experience of my life.
Nice.
But leading up to it, I was a wreck. I thought I was gonna have to pull from the race, and I think it brought up a lot of PTSD, and I literally had this terrible back pain. I mean, it was the worst pain I've ever felt in my life, and I was like, I don't want to take a muscle relaxer. I don't want to take a muscle relaxer.
Yeah.
Had to take a muscle relaxer, and it's the reason I was able to run the race.
Yeah.
But usually I try to be like pretty like natural in how I attack those things.
Yeah.
And it got me through the race, and it got me feeling good that I was able to complete that and have a really special, amazing life event with, you know, my partner and my family.
So good.
But it's conversations like this. It's like, I don't know how anyone would know that, like from my Instagram picture that I posted on.
Yeah.
That it's saying that I completed the marathon.
That you barely got there because you needed this tool. Look, like that's a great example of like the muscle relaxer and being able to get through. It also just brings up like how anxiety is so wild and that it plays like into so many parts of your body that you would have no idea that is because of anxiety. Mm-hmm. Like digestive issues are like front and center for me.
Oh,
and I've had so many doctors like, well, you're anxious. And I was like, well, that seems like a BS excuse. Like fix me. And sometimes they've been wrong. And like I had an ulcer a couple summers ago and it was like, how did I get these things? Probably tension and tightness and the way I carried body and how I was eating and all these things. And you say toolkit, I always think of it like an NBA team where I'm like, you have a lot of players on the floor at the same time and you need all these things. And so for me, the SSRI is like my point guard. Like it's always out there. It's running the offense a lot of times. It's there. But you need a center, you know, like in my center is prayer. Like if I'm praying and like, you know, I'm strong man of faith, Christian faith. And I have like I always say, because Christians become so funny, it's like been politicized like everything these days. But I always say like, I'm really strong to the teachings of Jesus. Like what did Jesus teach? And like, if you look at Jesus' teachings, like he was like the ultimate mental health guy. Like he would go off on his own in seclusion. He would pray. He would take time away. Like if he was in crowds too long, he would like go off on his own and take breaks, like Sabbath, taking a day of rest. Like he was speaking the same language. Like if you just follow and practice this in a way, like not holding so dearly to like wealth and holding to like what people think about you and really giving yourself up for something bigger. And all of those things are in my toolkit. If, you know, when I am feeling particularly stressed, if I go to prayer, you know, and I start like, you know, come on, Holy Spirit, help me out here. I got this, like, this feeling, this emotion. I can feel it release out of my body. And then sometimes it's just physical exercise. And, you know, like my wife, she's going to wake up every morning to exercise because it's best for her mental health. She's like, this is my SSRI. Like, I'm doing this. And for me, I'm, you know, if I'm eating right, physical, like these are all things that go together. So to your point, it's not just one thing.
Yeah.
It is oftentimes a lot of these things. But then also imagine how hard that is for if you're introducing someone who just feels like shit. Like they're like, I don't know how, like I feel anxious, I feel stressed, I'm in pain. And they're living their life that way. They don't even know what normal feels like anymore. And then you start saying, you got to do breath work, man. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, duh, no wonder you don't feel good. You're not doing breath work. You're not taking an hour a day to meditate. You're not like, and then imagine that person's a parent or, you know, has a hard taxing job or is commuting 2 days or 2 hours a day or whatever that looks like. That is where, if there's anything I think as a society we have to help solve for, is making it not feel so intense. And I think that's where we're at right now. There's so many tools. And it's like, you got to be on this app and you got to do this thing every day and you got to take this and you got to eat this way and you got to. And now I have this checklist that's causing me more stress and anxiety than I already felt. And what am I going to do in return? I'm going to sit in front of Netflix and watch like a thriller show that's going to like mess me up even more before I go to bed and not get enough sleep, yada, yada. So I think that's the hard part. We talk about holistic health and mental health so tied together, but the keys and all these things can feel so overwhelming. How do you give people just like one thing every day to do that's better for yourself and start stacking these habits? And, you know, I mean, it can be a lot.
I mean, it's letting go the perfectionism of it all, because it's like, I talk to so many people where faith is part of their mental health journey, but like faith doesn't look the same for everyone, of course. Mm-hmm. But what I have found, because I've had such a complicated relationship with my spirituality, my mom was raised me as Catholic, my dad is Hindu, and that was very confusing as a kid.
Yeah, I bet.
But now
Catholicism by itself is very confusing, so I can only imagine adding in some other ingredients. There.
Well, it's a lot of times it's outside perspectives that's perpetrating that pressure.
Yeah.
And now as an adult, I have found like there are bits and pieces of stories from both religions, but even like Buddhism, that inform my version of a spirituality. And that's kind of like what Sparkle is about. It's about healing. You know, I define it as your happiness, your passion, and self-worth. And so it's embracing these different nuances and these identities about yourself. So if you like some aspects of Buddhism, or mm-hmm. if you like some aspect of like, if going to church every Sunday helps you, then like that is what you have to embrace about what makes you shine. And what's amazing about people's shine is there's also a darkness, but that's what makes you you, and that's what makes you beautiful. And what I admire about your journey is that you have dedicated your life to storytelling and, you know, this mental health advocacy, that also happens to be why you're very successful in your professional career. What is like your biggest advice to people to follow their most authentic journey?
Yeah. Well, first, thank you. I would say that that authentic journey piece of it is so tough. We have such a demanding world to be a certain way, act a certain way. Mm-hmm. The corporate culture of this world is so backward when it comes to trying to find to be yourself, to mm-hmm. be this version of yourself. Because business doesn't care. Business wants you to, we need this thing done this time. Like, we all say these things like, oh, we're going to, you know, mental health day once a year or whatever, you know, we're going to have like scalp massages in the lobby or whatever. Like, that stuff doesn't change. And so I think there's a lot of resistance against people being their genuine, authentic self. And so to counter that, I think it really does come down to community. And what is that community you could be yourself with, you know, and what's that? And going back to like my kids, like I have a son who's brilliant when it comes to creativity. Like my older boy is wants to make movies and create, and he's obsessed with like making a movie with me. Like, we're remaking Napoleon, and we're like, this budget is like, we're way over budget. I told him, I was like, the production budget, we're buying like costume. He's got it all set up, scripts and stuff.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's really, you know, seeing this creative side. And I'm like, he doesn't, you know, I'm excited for him to find his tribe, like the people that want to do that with him at his age and create. And he's got his best pal who likes doing it with him. So they've been, you know, doing plays now for months and months and creating these things. But I think for us to be genuine, you have to find people that allow you to be that way, mm-hmm. and being okay with what that group looks like. Like, not feeling like I need to go fit in with this group because for whatever reason, like they live near me or they're cool kids at the school or they're whatever. Like, go be with the people who allow you to be you.
Yeah.
And I guarantee you'll be swimming with the current. And, you know, that's kind of my biggest piece of advice is just find your community and don't be alone. Alone is not good. I will say that. Like, that is one piece that I will probably fight against the open mind. Someone's like, I just like being alone. I say, well, you need to be with people because I believe we're, you know, it kind of goes back like, why are we here? These existential questions. But like, I think we're here as one great community. And I think it's funny you mentioned kind of like different religions, and I haven't studied other religions enough to know. I didn't walk into this thing, by the way, to become a Christian. I didn't necessarily grow up like in a church every Sunday environment. Mm-hmm. I became a Christian on my own in my late 20s. I had like a very supernatural experience and literally like story for another podcast, but like a true vision of Jesus. Like, that's, and it sounds crazy to say and like people, but like that changed my life from that moment on. And in that, I started to build my community. What that looked like. But in that was, I never felt, and this is why I've always struggled with the thought of telling somebody that their religion is wrong or mine is right, or I've struggled like feeling like the rules part of religion is chief, because the only time, and through this whole journey of like, imagine I just, what I just said, right? I just had a vision of Jesus. Like, okay, what does that mean? What does that entail? Mm-hmm. I had this very overwhelming thing happen to me that changed the direction. But as I continued to walk and understand, kind of, I had to make sense of the Bible to that and understand what that is. But in those teachings and in all of that was really, what has God always pulled me to? It's always been very simple, this message of love and building community. And so what that looks like is like, there's people hurting that you can help. There's people that need help that you could step in, open a door, not like literally open a door, but maybe that too. But like, who can I lift up in some way? And so to me, it's always made a lot of sense. Like this idea of faith and higher power and purpose was we are all one body. Like we are all, so I'm helping you, you're helping me. Like we're all this thing collective. And so for me in my journey in faith and all of these things, it does come down to community and that we all have gifts and unique gifts kind of form like the left hand part of the body, you know, and you could act as that, but it helps the whole body and some good hippy dippy theology. But basically my, you know, my point is community is so important and to be alone means you're not getting access to these other parts right. that will lift you up and be a gift. And I think like a lot of things today, and we talk about mental health, like drive us into solitude. And there's great studies like the Surgeon General released to say last year, I think, that was mm-hmm. massive around isolation and what that does to mental health.
Yep.
And I think we come out of COVID, a lot of people are isolated. A lot of people still like working from home. There's a lot of this stuff. And I understand, like, trust me, I understand. Like when I wake up in the morning, at, like I would love to just like throw on Netflix and like cup of coffee with myself. And, like solitude's not bad in spurts.
Right.
But building community is so important and getting that time there is so important.
Someone told me that community follows, and I think that starts with storytelling. And that's, and you know, you do it day in and day out, and that's really why you are this amazing guest on this show. So thank you so much for joining us for Sparkle On, Jimmy.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Bye-bye.